The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
Pushkin.
Hey, it's Sam. Before we get rolling, this month actually marks the 8-year anniversary of Talk Easy. I think we've done nearly 400 episodes in that time with people I had long dreamt of sitting with when I first started the show back in 2016. People like Tom Hanks, Margaret Atwood, George Saunders, Questlove, Jhumpa Lahiri, David Byrne, Ethan Hawke, Zadie Smith, Oscar Isaac, Margot Jefferson, David Sedaris, Stacey Abrams. The list really does go on and on. I should also add, both my mother and father have come on the program. If I don't mention them, I will get a call on Sunday morning. And yet, I have to say, sometimes I really do feel like we're just getting started here. That there's so much left to do. So many people I'd still like to sit with, ideas and subjects that I want to explore in further detail. And so if any of these 400-ish conversations have stayed with you over the past 8 years, inspired you to be more creative, or have just helped make meaning out of our brief time that we have here, I have a modest ask. Emphasis on modest, because it's not a lot. The first thing is to just share the show with a friend or a family member or anyone that you think may be interested in the kinds of conversations we have here each and every week. Secondly, if you don't already, be sure to click the follow or subscribe button at the top of the platform that you're listening to this right now. I know that sounds very simple and silly, but both Spotify and Apple have updated their apps and in that process have like unfollowed and unsubscribed people. We did not take it personally, but I think also a lot of people don't know that this has happened. Regardless, you can follow and subscribe us on all the platforms. If you're on Spotify, you can actually click that little bell icon. That way, every time a new episode drops in the feed, you will receive a notification about it. The last thing, if you want to go above and beyond, and if you've already done one and two, the third thing you can do is just share the show on social media. We're at Talk Easy Pod across all the platforms. You can always tag us if you'd like. We do try to share most of those in our feed when we can and when we see them. Doing any or all of these things really does ensure that we can continue making this program each and every Sunday. And the last thing, not to get terribly sentimental, but if you're listening to this right now, whether it's your first time or the 400th time, thank you for being here. Because when I started the show in April of 2016, I was 21 years old, fresh off a job at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco that I wasn't particularly good at. I didn't really know what I was going to do next, and there is no way I could have imagined that TalkEasy would turn into what it's become, that it would reach so many, mean so much to so many. So with that, to everyone who has reached out over the years, whether it's an email, a message on Instagram or Twitter or in person, a text, whatever you've done, or if you've just been quietly following along, thank you. Making something each week takes a lot out of all of us here that make it. And so every bit of encouragement that we've received, thank you for doing that. And it really does help us continue moving forward, because it's not easy to continue moving forward. And with that, before I get even more sentimental, I'm just going to say, if you have any ideas for future episodes, you can always drop us a line at sf@talkeasypod.com. That's sf@talkeasypod.com. The newsletter is finally almost coming. I know I've been talking about it for like a year. You can subscribe to that by writing that email address, sf@talkeasypod. You can also visit our website at talkeasypod.com, where there's a spot to subscribe. But 8 years, it's worth celebrating and acknowledging. And none of those years would have been possible without you listening. So thank you again. And with that, here is Dev Patel. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by actor and director Dev Patel. Dev broke out over 15 years ago in a film called Slumdog Millionaire, which won 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. He was only 18 years old at the time and had assumed, I think fairly, that a fruitful acting career would follow, one filled with interesting, complex roles like the one Danny Boyle created to jumpstart his journey into movie making. But that's not exactly what happened. Instead, Hollywood did what it does best to people they don't understand: offer typecast, stereotypical roles that were caricatures of Patel, an Indian origin British actor. The roles verged on racist, or at the very least, one-dimensional. And so for a decade, Patel fought through what he calls a sea of nothing, choosing choice parts in films like Hotel Mumbai, The Green Knight, and Lion, for which he received a Best Supporting Actor nomination in 2017. He did all this while harboring another dream: to step behind the camera and tell a story his grandfather had been telling him since he was a young boy growing up in Northwest London. That story about a Hindu god who seeks retribution against corrupt leaders victimizing the poor has now become Patel's directorial debut, a new movie called Monkey Man. Here's a clip from the trailer.
In this city, the rich don't see us as people.
Give me the job no one wants to do.
I'll do it.
Anyone who forgets their place, it doesn't turn out well for them.
This is not the place to work if you can't handle that sort of stuff.
Every day, I've prayed for a way to protect the weak.
That was from the new film, Monkey Man, now playing in theaters across the country. We talked to Dev a few weeks after the film premiered at South by Southwest, where it won the Audience Award, which makes a whole lot of sense because this is a movie that needs to be seen in a theater. The action is propulsive and visceral and completely insane. Think The Raid Redemption or John Wick with a lot less cats. There were multiple times when I was watching this movie that I yelled at the screen in absolute disbelief. Like, I could not believe what I was seeing. I was so enthralled and mortified by the action, some of which I had to watch through the cracks of my fingers because I could not bear what was on screen. It is a one-of-a-kind action movie and exactly the kind of film that you do not want to watch at home by yourself. It's meant to be played in a crowd with the audience, yelling at the screen together. It really is something I can't recommend highly enough. And evidently, Jordan Peele and his company, Monkey Paw, felt the exact same way I did, because without Peele, this movie would have been straight to Netflix or Max or one of those streamers, and you would have just watched it at home. And instead, Monkey Man is exclusively in theaters around the country. If you want to see if it's playing at a theater near you, you can visit our website at talkeasypod.com. You can also click the link that we've put in the description. And so today, in Act One of the show, we talk about the decade-long journey that Patel went on to make Monkey Man possible. If there was ever a film that needed a director's commentary, it's this one. Then, in Act Two, we get into Patel's personal story, which may help explain why he did everything in his power to get his directorial debut to the finish line. And then finally, in Act Three, we talk about what this film means to him now having made it, what he's learned from these last 15 years in Hollywood, and what he hopes to make in the decade ahead. This is Dev Patel.
Dev Patel.
How are you, man?
Nice to meet you.
Likewise.
How you doing?
I'm good.
Anything interesting happening in your life?
There's so much happening. You know, finally giving birth to this little gremlin that's been occupying most of my life for over 10 years.
Like so, a decade. Yeah.
That thing.
Do you call it a gremlin often?
I do. I've said this before, but it's really been an obsession. I think anyone within a 5-foot radius of me at some point in recent history has thought I'm insane. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been a long journey.
Why don't we just start with your insanity?
Okay.
That is this new film of yours. It's called Monkey Man. It's your directorial debut. You're also the star and the co-writer of it, which is based on the story of Hanuman, the Hindu god whose shape is half monkey, half human, who uses his powers in the service of others.
Yeah.
This is a story your family has long been telling, because your father to this day wears a chain around his neck with little Hanuman statues. But I think it's your grandfather who first shared these epic Hindu stories on his visits from Kenya to Northwest London, where you grew up. As a boy, how did your grandfather explain these stories to you?
I mean, it was just, I was so desperate to spend time with him. He's such an incredible storyteller. He's so animated. He's got this kind of like half Indian, half kind of like Kenyan twang. And
do you want to imitate it for us?
I wouldn't dare. He looks like the old man from Up, the brown version. You know, he's got this beautiful head of like thick white hair. We just spent in my little box room. I'd make him sit in there and he'd tell me these stories of Hanuman and for me, it just reminded me of the iconographies of Superman splitting his chest open to reveal his S. Very, very similar to a story of Hanuman opening his chest up. Even the kind of way he's depicted flying is very similar to Superman. But as a kid that, you know, growing up in school, I guess I ran away from my culture or any sort of association to the Indian part of myself to fit in. And you know, I was afraid I was going to stick out or be bullied or... I didn't feel it was the coolest part of my identity.
What did you think was the coolest part?
I mean, you know, in the UK where I grew up, it's grime music and black culture, basically.
Mm. So this story didn't fit neatly within that.
Well, this story actually was one of the things that I should say was something that I thought, this is so cool and I'd love to share. But not in the way of this, you know, big mythical kind of camp epic in a way. So that's where this story was born, and trying to ground it and give it some weight and bring it into kind of today's world.
So that's kind of the mythological action side of it. But as you start to consider making this film, what did you want to tackle in terms of the caste system and the way there's a war on poverty? Because that's very much part of the writing of this movie.
I think revenge you know, this is a revenge film. Revenge is an incredibly maximal feeling. Mm-hmm. And I believe it needs as maximal a catalyst. And as a huge fan of the genre, it frustrates me when I see these kind of like run-of-the-mill, you know, streaming kind of action films that come and go in a second.
You want to name names here?
No, I don't. But for me, it is how can I double down, triple down on the culture and inject it into the genre and use it as a sort of Trojan horse to capture those guys that watch the John Wick movies, to middle of America, the guys that play video games and talk about things and, you know, the action structure all the way back from Bruce Lee in Game of Death. He fights his way up a pagoda. There's a caste system to action till you reach the biggest, hardest boss. In that case, it was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Mm-hmm. So for me, I was like, wow, we can talk about the caste system. If this guy infiltrates this club we call King's Club, where the untouchable elite, the kings of society go, and he's slaving away in this kind of windowless hellhole in the bottom, he can work his way up to challenge the gods of society. And we can talk about something richer within that kind of scaffolding, which is action.
So you bring all of this personal and political connection to the film. And it takes about a decade, is my understanding. You first were talked into writing it,
yeah,
which you didn't want to do. Then you tried to enlist Neil Blomkamp, who made District 9.
Yeah.
And he said, I think you should direct it. And come March of 2019, you told the New York Times, quote, "I have a film called Monkey Man that I'm going to direct this year, hopefully. It's like a graphic novel coming to life, and it's really exciting. It's also a heart attack in the wings."
Oh, boy.
Was March 2019 Dev right about March 2020 Dev?
Oh, boy. Was he right? And then some. I think he underestimated future Dev. What was really interesting about the Hanuman mythology was he's this incredible superhero, right? So if you go to India and you go to any gym in a slum there, you'll see Arnold Schwarzenegger on the walls. You'll see this British bodybuilder, Ronnie Coleman, and you'll see Hanuman. And he's in every rickshaw swinging underneath the mirror. And for me, when you start reading about the mythologies, he got punished for basically touching the sun. It's a story very akin to Icarus. And for me, he was someone that lost faith in himself and his abilities. And it's kind of life imitating art. I thought of this film. I knew everything about it, but I didn't have faith in myself. It's like, there's no way I'm going to be able to put a finger on a laptop and write something, so I should get someone else, let alone direct. And it was Neil that's like, dude, this is in you. It's in every cell of your body, or, you know, every corner, every frame of what you want to do. So yeah, I kind of took his faith and I kind of ran with it.
So when the pandemic starts,
yeah,
you get the last seat out of Mumbai to go back where?
We're in one of the biggest slums in Mumbai.
Okay.
I'm with my Korean DP. I've been there for months and months.
Scouting,
casting.
Right.
You know, there was a hairy situation with the financiers where, you know, money wasn't being released. So it was all of this stuff happening and I'm turning down projects and my agents are like, just come back, you know, don't worry about it. And I'm like, no, we're going to do this. And then we get whacked with this pandemic. And, you know, all the kids in the slums have mobile phones. So they're seeing us foreigners and they're pointing at us going, COVID. And it turned into, Mumbai was like 28 days later. Like everyone had left. Me and kind of the key players had underestimated what this actually was. So we're like, oh, this will blow over. And I was in this hotel. And by the end of it, there was only me and I think like 7 other guests. They'd switched off all the lights in the hotel and traffic had stopped. So the air had cleared up. You could finally see the clear skies in Mumbai. I could see the kind of cityscape from my window. But the dream had died. We had to get out and the film had basically tanked.
The financiers call you. They say, Dev, it's a pandemic. We're not making a movie. It's time to pack it in. Come home. What does your Hail Mary speech sound like to them? How do you convince them to keep going?
That speech hadn't happened yet. There's many kind of Braveheart speech moments. but you know, we'd spent so much time writing this. I'd turned down so much work. I was like, there's no way this is going to go down. And I had a feeling that it wasn't going to come up again if we just let it sit there and gather dust.
Right.
So my producing partner, Joe, I was like, dude, we got to be resourceful. We got to find something outside of the box. And he knew someone that he'd met at a festival in Singapore who owns a studio in Indonesia in this tiny island called Batam. And, you know, we're like, okay, how can we get there? We can create a bubble. He also owns this kind of golf course and a hotel. So we're like, we can create a bubble there and we can put all the crew there and we can do this. So we blagged to our financiers and they created this, you know, 100-page document of COVID protocols. And they're like, have you been to Indonesia and been to this place and scouted? I'm like, I've been there. I love it. It's incredible.
Complete lie.
Complete lie.
Will they be listening to this tape?
Yeah, probably. But when we landed, I remember looking at the sunlight and I turned to Joe and go, God, the sunlight, the texture of the light is so different to India. And I was like, dude, this is, here we go. And it was, you know, whoever we could get our hands on locally, we just went at it ferociously.
Take me to the Braveheart moment and that speech.
Yes. So the Braveheart moment was, it probably would have been a few weeks before principal photography when we were actually going to start shooting.
You're in Indonesia.
We're in Indonesia. Everything's going wrong. Literally, I think at one point we were running out of toilet paper. You know, they had the hotel catering. And, you know, for a film crew, you can't have kind of room service, like, you know, coming 2 hours late or half an hour late. You know, you've got an entire crew that marches on their stomach. So, I mean, these locations that I was scouting for months to do these complex action sequences would turn up to shoot and the military were there and they had been turned into red zones. The borders were closing. I broke my foot. One of the stuntmen stamped on and broke a couple of toes. And they hadn't really accounted for the COVID protocols of actually having to pay to quarantine someone for 2 weeks before they could even do a day of shoot. Mm-hmm. So the financier calls me and he's like, look, I've never done this, but I'm shutting you down and you got to come home. And
did he say it just like that?
Yeah, he said, I'm shutting you down. And I was like, no, you're not. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, you can't do this. We have 450 beating hearts on this island that have a purpose. And this is going to be genre bending. You have to trust me that through this chaos, through this fire, we will forge a diamond. And I said, I'm not going to leave. I said, you're going to have to get someone to cuff my hands and drag me out of here. But
did you get emotional on the speech?
I was really, because I knew it was slipping away. And I won't mention any names, but they'd sent someone from the studio. This said individual, you know, was intimidated by the, you know, seeing a rat in a slum or whatever. And I was like, how are we going to make this grimy, gritty vision of this underworld India if, you know, you can't show up to a location scout and you're moaning about craft services. Like, you know,
don't visit New York often.
Yeah. But he goes, okay, you know what? I'm going to give you 48 hours. So Joe and I, we went on a Zoom call because at that time there was a COVID scare on the island too. So we couldn't mix with anyone. So we went on a 17-hour Zoom call and it was with every HOD, I went on and I...
HOD is head of department.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. And I, you know, even down to the makeup department, I was like, okay, how many makeup brushes do you have? 30. Okay, make it 10. Props. How many bicycles do we have? 12. Okay, we need 3. I made some mistakes, you know, in terms of the breakaway tables that, you know, you throw the stuntmen on. I think we only had 3 or 4 in the end. So we did these huge action sequences. I'll throw a bad guy onto a table and then, you know, look as badass as I can. And then I'll shout cut and then we'd have to glue the balsa wood back together again.
You're on hour 16 of that call. Morale is what?
You know what? I was very emotional on the call and I said, look, it's up to each and every one of you to make some concessions. And, you know, every head of department, they feel like their part of production is the most important part, which is incredible, you know. So
it has to be like that.
It has to be like that. But I said, for the greater good of the picture, we need to find a way to be more resourceful. And the term I'd picked up when I was scouting in India was this word in the slums I use called jugaad, which is, it kind of means resourcefulness, this kind of like clucky attitude by any means necessary. You can be adaptive and resourceful. And I always use the example of this guy I saw with this plastic bag that he twisted the four corners to make a hat. And, you know, you can poke holes in it and make it a fishing net or cover the roof of your leaking tin roof. And that was the thing we went through. And everyone responded. Everyone cut down. Some people cut salaries. Even Mike Willowan, who's the man that owns the studio, I think he slashed the rate of the studio by over half to let us keep filming there. So I feel hugely grateful to my Indonesian crew.
So you're in production. You start filming. Pretend I'm a medical examiner or like a concerned mother. You broke your hand on this film?
Mm-hmm.
You broke your toes on this film?
Yeah.
you tore a shoulder on this film. Is that a yes?
Not quite Jackie Chan. I mean, these are.
And you kept making this film.
Yeah.
What pain medication were you prescribed, and did you bring any for me today?
Actually, I refuse to take painkillers.
Stop. Not even an Advil?
No. Because I had to be so hyper-present. The amount of adrenaline coursing through my veins for 9 months.
See, I'm imagining them giving you whatever they give LeBron in game six of the NBA Finals.
Yeah, no. It was coconut water, sweet potato, salmon, and lettuce. That was it.
Okay.
I was a man possessed. I really was.
And that was enough to make it through production, even with all these injuries.
Oh, man. I mean, when my hand snapped in the first fight scene in this bathroom, I turned to Joe again in my DP and I go, I know it's broken. I heard it. I felt it. Every time I move, like, there's this nerve sensation flicking in my ear. And I was like, let's just finish it. Let's just keep going. And we knew if we had to put a cast on my hand, that's it. We couldn't afford to VFX out this thing. And again, the production was going to tank. So our assistant had found this cheap medical private jet to fly me to Jakarta. And, you know, we needed to prove to insurance that we weren't going to break this COVID bubble. So we went on this jet. I went under. They put a screw in. The doctor's like, if you put more than a pound or two of pressure on this hand and you bend that tiny nail, it's going to be like pulling a nail out of wood. You will ruin the bone around it and you won't be...
How do you not use your hand in an action film?
Oh, we went straight back into the action. I started throwing myself at a window and bouncing off it straight after. And you see it in the film.
Yeah, I saw it. I see it in the film. It's in the film.
You know, the biggest heartbreaking thing is I was so much better in the choreo room when I had two hands. So what you see is me doing some of this stuff one-handed, which slows you down, the kind of like, you know, nature of it. But
I think you did a good job.
Yeah.
People love asking actors about their creative process, how they prepare for the role, how they become the character that they're playing. But you've always said that your acting process is, quote, 90% panic and 10% it just happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I need that on a t-shirt.
Yeah, we'll make them for you.
Sounds like my sex life. No, it doesn't.
Noted. Glad we have that on record. When it comes to directing, what are those percentages looking like? Is it 90% panic and 10% it just happens? Or is it something else?
It was different this time. The amount of material that I'd been accumulating and gathering, you know, every film I would watch, you know, I'm sitting with my friends, I'd drive them crazy. I'm like, oh, we got to rewind that. I got to film that moment. I love the way the camera moves. Look at the lighting in that. Oh, wow. So watching a film with me for about the 2 years leading up to shoot was impossible. It was the most, you know, it would drive people crazy. I'd prepped the shit out of this thing, every angle, every thought. And then, you know, because of what was going on, we had to adapt. So it was having this plan and then being willing to just pivot. I'm not a very technical actor. I think I'm instinctual. And for me, that instinct really played a big key in making this.
The instinctual part of your craft, I think we can chronicle that back to the beginning of your career. Because in 2006, you're 16 years old. I think one day on her way back home from work, your mother's sitting on a train. She's flipping through the local metro newspaper. And it's then that she stumbles upon the casting call for teenagers in London. Now, again, you're 16. Like most teenagers, don't love listening to their parents. And yet she talks you into auditioning. Mm. How did you do that?
I mean, you know, I was just such a stubborn little rascal of a teenager. I had terrible acne. You know, we were struggling at the time and I just was like, you know, I really thought my parents were spiraling or something.
Struggling how?
Just financially.
Right.
You know, things weren't going well and it was tough. And I was just like, this is insane. You know, I've never done any sort of professional acting or been to an acting school and they're not going to cast any brown kids for sure. And We fought. And she's like, I'm not going to listen to you. We are going to bunk off school and we are going. And she goes, you're going to wear your uniform so your dad doesn't know. And then we're going to take the train to the National Youth Theatre. And we queued up. I got a number. It was like American Idol. I went in and totally was the most over-the-top, terrible audition I'd done. But I made him laugh. And that was the beginning of everything. And we talk about it. And I was like, you know, you were so close to cracking and how drastically different my reality would have been.
She was close to cracking.
Yeah.
As in she was close to listening to.
I nearly won. And trying to, I was painting, you know, how ridiculous this was to bunk an exam and go to the city and do this. You know, this newspaper, the Metro newspaper, is on every seat on the train.
Right.
It's craziness.
You get the part.
Hmm.
It's on a show called Skins.
Yep.
Where you play this wily, sex-crazed British Pakistani teenager.
Yeah.
Can we take a look at that?
Oh, boy.
For a second?
Okay.
All right.
Hope no one's had eating breakfast at the same time as watching this.
Yeah, this is a warning and a disclaimer.
Oh, no.
Where'd you hide the drugs then?
I don't have any. I thought you were bringing them.
No, you're going to put them in your turban.
I don't wear a turban, Chris.
I thought you were going to get one especially.
They look so disappointing when I'm not a terrorist.
Well, you're a very dull Muslim, Emma.
Ah! Ow! Shouldn't have got it out, Chris. Come on.
It was strict poker, fuck's sake. What do you want me to do?
You weren't even playing, you wanker.
Look, it's posh kids. All the boys are gay.
Yeah? Are the girls gay too?
Oh, boy. That's enough pain. Oh, boy. Wow.
What do you think watching that?
God, I was an awkward creature, wasn't I? So hyperactive. And no, there's not a single bone of subtlety in that performance. You know, if you watch, I'm actually sometimes mouthing the other characters' lines. Everyone, the ongoing joke was Dev would wake up 4 hours before. And I used to make up I had some elaborate bathroom routine, but I was just so nervous and reading the lines over and over and over again. My first ADR, like the additional sound recording, my mum came with me to that recording and none of us knew what to expect because I'd never done it before. And the first thing up was this sex scene.
But you were a virgin.
I was a virgin and we had one computer in the house, which my dad would do his accounting work on. So I couldn't, you know, do a lot of background research. So we had some James Bond tapes. So I watched some James Bond, you know, romance scenes, pull out some ice cubes and do all that kind of, you know, romance shit.
Like everyone's first
time. Yeah, and then I'm on set and the director's like, more chihuahua. And I think I was doing a scene where I was like humping away, trying to recite Hugh Grant films to last. And my mum's in the watching me through the glass and she turned to the men afterwards and she goes, he sounds just like his father. And I was like, we're trying to sell an action film here. I feel like this is not the right thing to be talking about, but it happened.
Well, no, I think it is because you explained how you made this film of yours.
Yeah.
But I think to fully understand the why, we have to know your story a bit. We don't have to keep talking about you having fake sex, but you said once to do the show, it felt like suicide in the community to put your kid into a TV show and let him drop out at 16.
Hmm.
That first line is severe. I mean, what did that feel like?
It was tough. I mean, we had these like, you know, local community events for the kind of local Indian community and we would show up. And I remember when I told my mom I wanted to leave school because I didn't fit. It was very tough for me. Everyone was giving my mother dirty looks and taking her aside. And they're like, how could you do this to your son? And, you know, everyone's trying to backseat parent someone else's child in the community. Everyone has something to say.
How did she handle that?
It was very tough. She's a carer for the elderly and we weren't doing well financially. So we kind of became that kind of family for a moment where they're like, oh, look at those guys. You know, there's a bit of a train wreck going on there.
Mm.
And at the same time, I'd go to school and it was quite a multicultural school. And, you know, you're naked on national television with your scrawny ass out. And we didn't have kind of media training or protection. I was going to a school in the outskirts of London. And so I was getting a bit of flack for being the butt of the jokes on the show. And there was all these chat rooms of like, you know, who's kiss, marry, kill, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I was always the one you would kill or the worst in the show. And there were some members of my school that were not happy with the kind of Muslim representation of this guy being quite wild. And there were some that were. So it kind of was quite divisive in that sense. So it was a prickly place to be for a while.
How did you handle that?
It was hard because I didn't even know what a boom mic was, you know, or what speed meant or rolling. The only word I'd been accustomed to watching movies was action. Literally, we went straight from being at home and being in school to on a film set and them calling action. It was as raw as you can get. And, you know, for me, going to central London was a big deal. So to leave and stay in Bristol in this hotel with all these other teenagers that were more experienced at life than me, and, you know, everyone's kind of drinking and a lot of shit was going down that I hadn't been exposed to, and I didn't quite know how to handle myself in that. And I was more caught up trying to be the funny guy to fit in than really focus on what was happening on set. So I remember looking back on that, and it was only when I met Danny Boyle, and actually there was actually a filmmaker on that, Adam Smith. I had one episode and he really saw me and spoke to me like an equal, not like a kid. And that really started to change. I started to get the idea of what acting was.
Even if those kids in the chat room didn't like your performance, there was one person that did, in Danny Boyle's daughter.
Yeah.
And she was the one that told him while he was casting Slumdog Millionaire to look at this young kid named Dev Patel.
Yeah.
When you met him for the first time, what did you think?
I mean, we turned up to the audition. Again, I was with my mom, and I think I was the youngest to turn up. And there was all these men with like beautiful designer stubble. And I was like, I'm not going to get this. And at that time, the film was aged up. There wasn't the youngest kids that basically steal the movie in Slumdog. So I went in and was doing the youngest part of the roles, you know, doing the pickpocketing scenes. And I knew I could be funny. So I had Danny in stitches. So I just went in there and I was like, let's go for it. I'm not going to be the handsome dude like these guys, but I'm going to go in there and make him laugh. And I did. And then he took me aside and he goes, you know, to lead a movie, you have to be still. He goes, you know, to support a movie, you can come in and display attributes and add different elements to the equation. But to be a leading man, the audience needs to enter you through your eyes.
Did you understand that?
At the beginning, I was like, what do you mean? That's not acting. Like, they need to see me do something. It took me a while to really grasp that. It was only when I was opposite an actor called Irfan Khan, who, you know, sadly passed away, who's a true...
One of the best.
Yeah, cinematic icon. Best. And Irfan, we did a scene where he figures out why I'm on the show. I'm chained to this chair in this police interrogation room. And one of the other officers, played by this actor, Saurabh Shukla, he kind of passes a lewd remark about this girl, you know, calls her something, the bitch of the slum. And then I'm going to go crazy. And Irfan's going to grab me and go, that's it. We find out why he's on it. And instead, as I'm whiling out, I'm expecting him to come and kind of like restrain me. Instead, he just gets up and leaves the set. There was a little sink on the side of the room, and he washes his face in the middle of the shot and comes and sits down with a towel. He pats his face down and he goes, so that's why you're here. And I just was like, what the hell did he just do? And then Danny brought me behind the camera to watch him, and he has the most soulful eyes. And yeah, it really recalibrated me at that moment.
In making this film, it was kind of your first or second time being in India, is that right?
Slumdog?
Slumdog, yeah.
I would say it was my first time consciously being
consciously.
There.
Yeah. You went as a little child.
I went as a kid, yeah. To a rural part for a wedding.
As a 17-year-old making this movie with like his headphones and his Nike shoes,
yeah,
not knowing what the hell you're seeing, how did you make sense of the community that you were part of and that you were now about to make work about?
It was every kind of preconceived conception I had of the culture, you know, growing up in Rainers Lane and trying to rid myself of that part of my identity to fit in and not be bullied and whatever.
The not cool part.
The not cool part, yeah. You know, I went there and the first thing I did was, you know, do a bunch of casting with, I don't know, must have been 30 of the most beautiful, captivating and interesting women I've ever seen or been exposed to in my, you know, existence at that point. And one after the other, this girl would come in and would do this scene together, torn jeans and girls with Led Zeppelin t-shirts on. And I didn't even know what that band was. You know, I was only listening to like Dizzy Rascal and like UK grime. And it really, really recalibrated me in a huge way. I made some of my closest friends that I still have today on that experience. And I fell in love with it. It was intoxicating because it was so surprising in every way. And you can just get lost there.
Did you feel enveloped in that community?
So when I went out there, they found Frida, and then they went down for 2 weeks for Christmas before we started filming, and I just stayed back. I was actually hoping to just try and hang out with her because I had a huge crush on her. But she went off and wasn't around.
So you're 17, yeah, and there by yourself.
Yeah, I'm there by myself, and I told Danny I want to just kind of feel the culture and let it kind of seep in. And I was very afraid, and I hadn't traveled alone before, but I had my per diem, which I was saving. So I put some in my pocket and I would walk the streets every day. And even though I looked like everyone, they could just, they call him a Ferengi, you know, like a foreigner. Mm. Could just tell that I was a foreigner with the way I moved and just my cadence. And, you know, it doesn't matter how chaotic India is and Mumbai is, everyone has this kind of ease. No one's in a rush to go anywhere. And so they could just sense it. So it took a while for me to kind of like find that. And then, you know, I spent all this time perfecting this accent. And then we shoot the movie, get done. And then a year later, Danny Ball's like, you know, the sound is not clear. We've got to redo it. And then I made him sound like a British dude from Rainer's Lane. It's my biggest regret. But no, it took a while.
You know, on the surface, it seems like that movie changed your life. I think it won like 8 Academy Awards.
Yeah.
But the roles after did not come as you expected.
Hmm.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to run the risk of sounding ungrateful because, you know, I think every guy with, you know, even a tickle of brown pigment in their skin had auditioned for that thing. And so I was very fucking lucky to get it. But I knew straight away when we went to Toronto Film Festival, you know, I'm the lead in this movie. The audience totally flipped out. And as soon as we leave the first screening, the paparazzi are outside and they're screaming, Frida, Frida. And she's, you know, this gorgeous, you know, ethereal being. She's a star. And they kind of, the security rushed her into this car, our car, and it started to leave. It drove off. And I'm standing there with the paparazzi, almost like, well, and then, you know, you see that moment from the frenzy where they just start reviewing the the photos. And I'm almost like joining in, like, oh, yeah, that's a good one. And like no one gave a fuck about the slumdog millionaire dude. And I knew.
Is that what you called yourself?
No. But like, I was like, I'm the slumdog. I'm the guy in the poster. I knew it was, there wasn't going to be a lot of room for me unless it was the, you know, IT dude or whatever. But also, you know, I wouldn't have had it any other way because I wasn't good enough as an actor already or deserving. I needed to earn some stripes.
Putting a pause on the conversation for a second. When we come back, we discuss Dev's career post Slumdog Millionaire, his work in the film The Green Knight, working on the TV show The Newsroom with Aaron Sorkin, and a whole lot more. Stay with us.
Hello, hello. This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. In my book, David and Goliath, I tried to figure out how some people find the strength to take on the established way of thinking and turn it upside down. What does it take to be a disruptor? And I concluded that a disruptor is someone with a rare combination of 3 traits. First, you have to be open. You have to be willing to see and do things in new ways. Secondly, you have to be conscientious, to follow through and make things happen. Those 2 are obvious. But the 3rd one is the crucial one. You have to be willing to do what you think is right, even when everyone around you thinks you're an idiot. There isn't a brilliant innovator in history who wasn't surrounded by naysayers. Most of us can't take that kind of criticism and we fold, but the disruptor doesn't. They soldier on. I've been looking at disruptors and their success stories a lot lately, partly because I'm working on a follow-up to The Tipping Point, and market disruption plays a key role in how ideas take off. But also because I'm going to be the keynote speaker at this year's Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business. It's an event where customers are recognized for kicking convention to the curb to elevate their company, while also doing meaningful things for their community and even the world. In fact, I'll be presenting the first ever Tipping Point designation, a new special distinction honoring one entrant that sparked transformative change for their organization. If this event sounds like your thing, I encourage you to find out more or even enter the Unconventional Awards to be recognized for your disruptive thinking. Win a donation to a charity of your choice, and much more. You can enter before July 31st at tmobile.com/unconventionalawards. That's tmobile.com/unconventionalawards. I'll save you a seat.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
When you look back on that period after Slumdog Millionaire, when you look back at The Last Airbender and all of that, which I know was a pretty tough shoot, What did that experience teach you about the kind of movies you wanted to make moving forward that you maybe even wanted to direct one day?
First of all, I needed a lot more training as an actor. And secondly, I should have listened to myself. You're a young kid and you all of a sudden get this agency. And, you know, you have all these adults in suits telling you, you know, okay, this is how you're going to do it. And you're going to do this franchise. You're going to do it because this other actor's just been pulled out and you're going to go in and you're going to get this much money on the third one and blah, blah, blah. And we've got it mapped out. And you're like, okay. And I kind of got coerced into this thing, which working with Danny Ball, you're feeling everything. You're in the trenches. It's a very different, even in Skins, you know, It's very different type of filmmaking to what that process. It was too Hollywood for me, you know.
What do you mean coerced?
I didn't consciously really make that decision to do it. I kind of just was like, okay, I guess I have to do this. And I didn't fit. I wasn't right for the role. And I was atrocious in it. Every moment of it was so soul-crushing in a way for me. And it showed in the film. And from that day onward, I was like, you know, I don't want to be this tiny cog in this huge McDonald's selling, you know, Happy Meal selling machine. I don't want to do that. No fucking way. Never again.
How do you move forward from that? It's one thing to read negative comments from angry, horny teenagers in a chat room.
Yeah.
But how do you move forward from that film?
Yeah, dude, the hardest acting is selling a movie you don't like. That's hard acting. And it's soul crushing looking someone in the whites of their eyes and trying to promote this thing.
Yeah.
So I'm trying my best not to find myself in that position again. How did I carry on? I just, my same set of friends, you know, I'm lucky I just got a few more goes. I got this Marigold Hotel movie and things like that. And then things started to pick up slowly.
It didn't deter you?
It didn't deter me, but I thought I was done. But I've been lucky.
You get a role on the show, The Newsroom. And the reason I kind of brought up that moment where you were low and felt bad was because when the show ended,
yeah,
some of your castmates reflected on the experience of making the program. And in an exit interview, when asked who was the most distracting, energetic person on set,
oh boy,
they had a sort of common answer, which I could read, but then I thought maybe you would want to read what they said.
It was Sam Waterston, wasn't he? He's so hyperactive, that guy. Adina Porter. She goes, Dev, that's why we can't have any nice things, Patel. Oh, boy. That's so true. Because, you know, Jeff's doing these, like, massive 12 pages, you know, and we're in the bullpen behind him whilst he's in the newsroom. We got these phones, and I figured out how to use the actual intercom system to talk to all the other actors. Mm-hmm. And I'm just breaking shit. And I'm, you know, it was, anyway, Dev has the energy of seven people. While sometimes distracting, the shenanigans were always funny and always welcome. Alison Pill. Oh, Alison. There you go.
So even after all that pain that you've been talking about, you somehow repurpose it into this energetic, wily, maybe ADHD, as you keep saying, performance.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was saying half the time in that show. All of it went over my head. I dropped out of school, man, at 16. So this stuff about, like, you know, I didn't know much about American politics. So I just learn it by rote, go in. And I was just excited to be there and, like, pay my dues again. I remember he was just the IT guy in the first read-through. He didn't have a name. They're like, just go to the read-through. It's Scott Rudin, it's Aaron Sorkin, and these actors and these thespians, like, you know, Thomas Sadowski. Holy shit, that guy's unbelievable. You watch him on set. Alison Pill, you know, like all of them, Jeff, Sam, Emily Mortimer. And I remember when Jeff does that speech, you know, why is America the greatest? And he's like, it's not, but it could be. I remember watching him in the read-through and I was like, okay, I don't care if I'm the IT guy. I'm going to sit and take note of these guys. So it was kind of, that's why I did it, yeah.
It is a profoundly energetic performance.
Yeah.
And it is very far away from the thing that Danny Boyle told you you'll need one day, which is a stillness.
Yes.
Was Lion the first time that you brought and delivered that stillness?
Yeah, I think I live in these kind of extremes, but there is a kind of old man in there too inside me that's like to think soulful, and the opportunity to be soulful came with Lion. And I read that script and I wasn't really their first choice at all because I was that Indian guy that's been in Slumdog. And I think filmmakers didn't want that baggage. They wanted to find a newer, fresher face. And
Ang Lee called you overexposed.
Yeah, overexposed.
You couldn't audition for Life of Pi.
I couldn't, no. And I was, you know, everyone's like, Dev's just the guy that's doing all the Indian stuff. And I was like, actually, I've kind of, Slumdog was like this amazing gilded cage where I'd like, it'd become so huge that I kind of like was so overexposed, but couldn't do much else after. And it, you know,
it's amazing. One Dev Patel is overexposed, but we somehow have room for like five famous Chrises.
Yeah, I know.
The math is just not mathing for me. It doesn't make any sense.
Totally, dude. And
it's no offense to them. It's not, and I don't, it's not about them.
Yeah.
It's an industry.
It's an industry.
It's an industry problem.
100%. And when Lion came up, I had to audition six times. Garth changed my life with that role. And the first
the
scene, Garth Davis, the first scene we shot was the last scene of the film where I meet the mother. And I poured everything of myself into this. Just been through a breakup and I was unanchored in the world and ready to apply myself wholly to something. And that was that. That was that film.
You demonstrated what Danny wanted you to do, what he said you'll one day need to do in Lion. You then do it again in the film The Green Knight. I want to sit with this one because you're in your early 30s playing this character who desperately wants to be great. And yet the central question of the film is, but at what cost? Did you see yourself in that character and in that potentially fateful desire to be great?
First of all, God, do I love David Lowery. Again, talk about soulful, and like that script was, it was like music. It was so lyrical. And everyone that had been exposed to it had a different takeaway. But for me, it was, you know, on this journey of ambition and trying to stamp your mark. In this story, it's about a young man trying to sit at a table of great men with great stories, and he needs to create a story of his own. And there's a beautiful line in it, which is, you know, instead of striving for greatness, why not strive for goodness instead? And that really struck me because, you know, I've met a lot of people and seen a lot of people change throughout this time, and it's all consuming, this game. And, you know, I get to see people in the wings. I get to see them turn on their crocodile smiles and we do a big Q&A panel or whatever. And then you get to see them, what they're like to their assistants or what they're like in the makeup trailer. And, you know, everyone has a bad day. You know, it's a very pressurized position to be in. But for me, it's like, it is tough. It's a tough industry. And I remember the press tour for Lion and how beautiful making the movie was. Garth took us out into nature and made us find the leaf that matched our soul. And we listened to music and we didn't do rehearsals. We did bonding exercises and earthing and grounding. And it changed me as a human. And then you go and do what they call a press campaign. I mean, you're campaigning for yourself to be nominated for an award. What an amazing position to be in. But also, you know, you're talking about yourself for months and months on end. And, you know, it's the complete opposite of what making the film was.
And why you got into this.
Yeah, you're hitting the same taglines over and over again. And you're kind of selling yourself. It was a lot. Let's say this is a cliche, but at the top of my career, which I consider that, you know, being nominated for an Oscar, I felt inside the most turbulent, the most lonely.
But what does that feel like?
I mean, you're at these soirees, these events with, you know, the magnificent, most magnificent, incredible, talented individuals that look like gods. And to me, they're worthy of being there. I've watched them on screen and they fit, and I feel like a fraud.
You didn't think you were worthy?
No, even then I didn't feel worthy.
And now?
I don't know if I ever will, unfortunately. I think that's an issue I'm trying to deal with, but it also probably is what is the furnace within me. Indian parents, man.
But is there anyone more proud?
Yeah, both my parents have been incredible. Yeah.
But when you say, but Indian parents, man, what does that actually mean?
You know, I just think...
This is the first time you've avoided eye contact.
No. I was thinking about it. I was like, you know, because my mom doesn't know. I remember when I got nominated, she goes, one day maybe you'll get nominated for the real one. I go, what's the real one? She goes, the leading one. And I was like, oh, mom, oh my Lord. I had to sit down and explain.
Yeah.
Well,
there's therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That will do it.
Yeah. But she was proud as punch coming. She was my date to the ceremony, and that was pretty cool.
The line was, you're striving for greatness, but why not goodness?
Yeah.
You said once, ambition is beautiful, but you have to remember what you're doing it for. And at the beginning of this conversation, we were talking about that ambition, your desire to make this movie, the lengths you and your crew were willing to go to make this movie. Now that you've made it, do you have a better idea of who or what you were doing it for?
I think I was doing it for little Dev, young Dev, who, you know...
Acne Dev?
No, yeah, Acne Dev. I was doing it for Acne Dev. Big Ed, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air haircut Dev. My gateway into cinema was watching Bruce Lee, you know, a guy that had similar skin color to me and dark hair and all that.
Enter the Dragon?
Yeah, Enter the Dragon, man. Changed my life. And I wanted to be expressed in the genre. I wanted to exist in the genre. I want people like me to exist. After South By, you know, this Indian man came up to me and he goes, I'm jealous of my 14-year-old son. And I was like, that's a really weird thing to open a conversation with. And he was holding my hand and shaking and wouldn't let go. And I go, what do you mean? And he's like, it's the first time he's got someone on screen in a film like this that looks like him to look up to. And he goes, I'm so proud of you and keep it up. And I again was like, I don't know, maybe it was my hormones that day, but it was, I'm not the best with compliments, but that one caught me off guard and it meant the world because that was the objective of it.
Making this film was hard.
Mm.
The pre-production was hard. The production was hard. Yeah. The post-production sounds like it was hard.
Yeah.
I want to know, when you're struggling in post-production, what did Jordan Peele see that others could not?
We got on our first conversation was almost 3 hours long, and he understood what I was going for, which is to use genre as a Trojan horse to talk about more stuff. I didn't want to just do a film that just had a barrage of punches and kicks that kind of wash over you like a video game. I wanted the emotional punches, the political punches, the kicks to mean something too, and kind of wrap it in this kind of film that will, you know, people will access. If you want to talk about, you know, violence against women, you know, about the caste system, against, you know, religion, basically it's a revenge film about faith. He got all of those things. As a guy, you know, who does that incredibly well, you know, with his films, I think he saw that. And at the same time, you know, he's someone that's kind of was able to step out of a kind of box that he was put in and reinvent himself, you know. And there's a line in Monkey Man, this character Alpha tells me, he goes, you know, you need to destroy in order to grow, to create space for new life. I was reading about, you know, the Aboriginals in Australia and controlled burnings in order to nourish the soil, to create new life. And I just thought, what an incredible philosophy. It's like, you know, I had to destroy myself, my old avatar of myself, destroy everything. And I wanted to destroy the image the audience had of me or all of those, even the guys that we'd hired, that we fired because they overlooked me as just this, you know, oh, he's just this silly actor. This is going to crumble. We're in Indonesia and they're not helping. I wanted to prove them all wrong. I wanted to destroy that perception.
And did you?
I mean, the last song in the movie is called Grow by Faisal. And that's me hopefully growing and showing, you know, this is a new chapter, I hope.
Your father is fond of quoting a philosopher.
Tagore.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad doesn't quote a lot, by the way. He doesn't talk a lot at all. So when he dropped those lyrics, I was like, Dad.
The lyric was, I've spent many days stringing and unstringing my instrument while the song I came to sing remains unsung.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you now?
I couldn't let it go because...
The film.
Yeah. I mean, I'd actually walked off it when our financier went bankrupt and they kind of took the film over and were doing a bad job with all the sound and the color and the VFX. So I'd left it because I couldn't endorse it. And then, you know, we had such a short time with Universal to kind of make it mine again and undo all of the kind of stuff that, you know, some random third party had done to the movie. But, you know, there was many a times when I was writing this long text on my phone to apologize to my cast and crew for letting them down. And I never sent it, thank God. But, you know, at one point I told my dad, I can't endorse this. I can't be like in this movie. He's a performing monkey for a crowd. I don't want to be that performing monkey for something I've worked so hard on if it's not going to be what I want it to be. And he told me this quote and he goes, I'm with you, son, but remember this. And I was like, fuck, I got to sing this song because, like I said, young Dev, you know, he would want to see it. People like me will want to see this and feel it. So, yeah.
There's a line in the movie, I think, the pain will leave you once it's finished teaching you.
Yeah.
What has it taught and has it left?
The pain hasn't left. But what it taught me is to never take no for an answer. I really found this next level, possessed level of belief in this thing. And I've never had that before. And, you know, that's what it's taught me is to believe in myself a bit more.
Last question. Now that you have this new belief in yourself.
Kind of. Not totally.
Okay.
Half-baked belief.
Confidence adjacent.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
The one that the awkward teenager with acne did not have. Mm. The one that went to India for the first time and discovered a new life, a new community that he'd always been sort of looking for. The one that had trouble on an M. Night Shyamalan movie, rebounded in these films, was deeply, profoundly energetic on The Newsroom. The one that made Lion possible, The Green Knight possible. What do you want for yourself moving forward?
I'm learning. I'm trying to be kind to myself. But that's what I'm trying to do. But what I want for myself is, I guess I want to keep making stuff. I know what rarefied space I am to be able to greenlight a movie and make a movie and even get any form of financing behind that thing. So, you know, I feel the responsibility and I want to keep telling stories. That's what I want for myself. Dive back into the fire.
And to that kid whose father is jealous that he gets this movie, you say what?
What do I say? I say, all, you know, this movie is about someone that's scarred, right? He has physical and emotional scars. And those scars, I hope other characters and people around him, what they do in this movie is they're not signs of trauma. They're actually signs of triumph. They're signs of someone overcoming something. They're, you know, a scar is a sign of a warrior. You came over something. Mm. That's what the motto of this film is. So what I would say is, you know, for every time you've been knocked down or bruised or emotionally or whatever, we should play I'm a Survivor. But no, but yeah, keep going, man. Keep going.
I don't know if I can clear the rights for that song.
Yeah.
Time.
Okay. Keep on trucking.
Get back up.
Yeah. Get back up.
Dev Patel.
This was amazing. I appreciate you. Thank you for that. It felt like therapy.
Yeah, I'm not going to charge you. Don't worry. Congratulations on the film. We've gone through all these sort of chapters of yours.
Mm.
And I'm so glad that you made it through to the other side. And I so look forward to seeing what you make next.
Thank you, man.
Good luck.
Thanks. That was amazing. You're amazing. You're incredible, man. What a talent you have.
Hello, hello. Malcolm Gladwell here from Revisionist History, my podcast about the overlooked and the misunderstood. A couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Outliers. It was about exceptional people, the ones who operate at the outer edges of human performance. Outliers fascinate me. And last year, I discovered an outlier in the form of a community organization. Washington State's city of Bellevue. The city wanted to improve public safety by making their roads safer. So they created something that no one had ever built before, a platform that gave road users warnings of any dangers ahead in real time. How did they build it? By using a combination of technologies, the Cellular Vehicle to Everything Network, T-Mobile's 5G network, and 5G-connected cameras. People driving, bicycling, walking, running, can't forget people running, and people operating the transportation network now had a way to prevent crashes. It's been a huge success. The city of Bellevue earned first place in the community category at the T-Mobile for Business Unconventional Awards, an event that celebrates T-Mobile customers who've dared to innovate for the sake of meaningful change. If you're a T-Mobile for Business customer and your team has, like the city of Bellevue, innovated something really, really cool, I encourage you to enter. It's also a great way for outliers to be recognized in front of your industry's most influential leaders. You can enter at tmobile.com/unconventional awards. That's tmobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code. A lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode with Dev, the best thing you can do to continue supporting Talk Easy is to share the program on social media with a friend, a family member, anyone that you think may be interested in the kinds of conversations we have here each and every Sunday. You can also leave us a review on Apple, Spotify, wherever you do your listening. If you want to drop me a line, you can do so at sf@talkeasypod.com. That's sf@talkeasypod.com. You can send us ideas for future episodes, reflections on the episodes you have heard, or if you just want to say hello, drop us a line at sf@talkeasypod.com. We are in the process of doing a special new project in collaboration with our listeners. So if you want to be part of that, drop us a line at that email address. I want to give a special thanks this week to the teams at Shelter PR and Universal, and of course, our guest today, Dev Patel. Be sure to check out his new film, Monkey Man, exclusively in theaters around the country. To learn more about Dev and his work, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. If you want to hear other conversations with actors and directors, I'd recommend our talks with Cate Blanchett, Oscar Isaac, Ethan Hawke, Tom Hanks, and Lily Gladstone. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at Talk Easy Pod. If you want to purchase one of our mugs or our vinyl record with the inimitable Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at talkeasypod.com/shop. As always, Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Today's talk was edited by Clarice Guevara and mixed by Andrew Vastola. It was engineered by Stephen Toll at CityBox out of New York City. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Our illustrations are by Krisha Shenoy. Our graphics are by Ethan Seneca. Today's photographs were by Kyle Manning. Our research comes from Sharia Aronke. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin Industries. Justin Richmond, Carrie Brody, Jacob Smith, Eric Sandler, Kira Posey, Jordan McMillan, Tara Machado, Sarah Nix, Malcolm Gladwell, Greta Cohn, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to another episode of Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next Sunday with a new talk. Until then, stay safe and so long.
Our kids have said to us since we moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry, and me, I'll be there too. Enter now at tmobile.com/unconventionalawards. See you there.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.